And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
With just 26 letters, all the wisdom in the English language has been penned. And with just 7 notes and 5 half notes, all of the world's music has been written. And with just 3 primary colors, all of the colors on earth can be mixed. Taken together, these 39 elementaries have driven the creation of the finest expressions of the master mammals on planet Earth. We look at this and more as we go in depth with the visionary art of Jen Troot when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As we count down to next year's election, or perhaps even more amazing, the primaries in less than 2 months, the 17 or so presidential candidates are trying to paint a clear picture of who they are and where they stand on the issues. All of the political commentators are looking for the unique characteristics of the candidates that help them stand out. Show us who they are. Well, here's my observations. If you look at just the last names of the candidates, the most common letters are the N, with a total of 11, then E with 10, and A with 9. The candidates with the most frequency of the top 3 letters are Giuliani, Huckabee, and Tancredo, tied with 3 each. All of the candidates, except one, contain one or more of the top 3 letters. If you're looking for the unique candidate, it's Dodd, with 3 D's and an O. No top letters in his name. And the letters J, Q, X, and Z are not represented by any candidate. You'll have to draw your own conclusions. In the next year, each of us will be subjected to millions of words by these candidates, and still, we may not see clearly who they are. We may need a better way of interpreting these complex issues. The same is true in our current challenge to understand the complex issues facing us about our environment. With so much information coming at us, it can become difficult to make our way through the counterbalancing forces at work on this, our little Earth. But we may be overlooking one of the most powerful human creations for understanding the complexities and depths of meaning. Art. And that's where we're going with today's show, as we go in depth with artist Jen Troot, whose powerful work surveys the current state of the art of our floundering arc. Artists use their vision to help us see. We'll be talking with Jen during both segments 1 and 2, following this week's abbreviated Weekly Earth Summit and News. So now, the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Today, we have a briefing from two of our regular guests. We begin with Dr. Charles Kennell, who is launching the new Sustainability Institute at the University of California, San Diego, following his role as director of the prestigious Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Dr. Kennell provides his panoramic vision of the pathways that need to be forged by new generations of change agents. Dr. Kennell?
I would call this second generation solutions. The first generation of solutions have been thought up and have been in the advocacy literature for about 20 years. And they are simple things that are now beginning to happen. For a long time now, people are advocating going to hybrid cars. Well, now some people are building them. and some people are making them attractive to consumers. Something that you hear on the radio all the time now here in Southern California is that global warming is not only a fact, but it's an opportunity. And you need now to think about things like replacing your incandescent bulbs with fluorescent bulbs, which use about a fifth the energy. And so there are some simple things that we can do, that we all know how to do, that we should do. Change our lighting, insulate our houses, buy a more modern refrigerator. All of these things will help. But at the end of the day, those are just the first steps. We need to do them, but we're going to find after 10 years when we've done them that we've still got a problem. And so, and it's in the 10-year horizon that the scientists and the engineers have to think, or the 20-year horizon, because we really need to transform the way we do much of our commerce and our business and our engineering. And so now, in this particular area, the engineers are saying, well, what we need to engineer is a worldwide information network that will give us continuous awareness of the state of our environment so that we'll always know what's going on and we'll make fewer mistakes in our decisions. But it's got to be a global thing. It's got to be a Google for the environment with all sorts of key information that's easy for people to understand, reliable, up-to-date, and addresses their problems. Not just the problems that scientists want to see addressed, which are very important and will always provide the basis, but also the problems that people have. And so that gets you into a totally different kind of information network that uses spacecraft and sensor nets and stream gauges and measures the snow and the snowpack and the green color of the ocean to know where all the chlorophyll-bearing plants are. That we all know how to do, but now it's time to tie it all together, make it useful to people, and the system engineers are going to play a role in that.
Thank you, Dr. Cannell. And next we hear from one of those emerging change agents, Ben Lowe, who is working with Aroca.org while serving his community in the Chicago area. Ben?
It's not easy being green. Kermit the Frog is famous for that song, and many people continue to use it as a pretense for not living sustainably. Often, it is a shameful excuse that reflects our laziness and apathy more than anything. But there may also be some truth to this statement. Going green can often be complicated and sometimes challenging. I recently moved to a neighborhood in inner city Chicago with some friends. We've made a lot of changes in our apartment, such as switching all the light bulbs out to compact fluorescents and hang drying clothes on the line. But when we wanted to recycle, we just couldn't figure out how. Apparently, the city has an extensive blue bag recycling program that gets proudly promoted everywhere. Even so, our landlord and neighbors did not know how the system worked. We finally looked it up online and found a list of stores where we could pick up the blue recycling bags at. The next problem? That none of the stores on that list in our area actually carries the blue bags or even knows where to get them. After a few frustrating weeks of searching, we now stockpile our recycling by the back door and take it all into the suburbs to throw away when we happen to be out there. I suspect that most of our neighborhood does not actually go to such lengths to recycle, however. Whether it is trying to recycle, choosing between paper, plastic, and styrofoam, or sorting through the myriad of other confusing programs, advice, and options, there are many ways we can still help make it easier and more accessible for our communities to go green. We need to take the good science we know and apply it more effectively through awareness, education, and implementation. But let's not overlook the details, too. For one, I happen to know a neighborhood in Chicago that really needs blue recycling bags.
Thanks, Ben. Join us each week as we bring you the leading voices for a better world on the Weekly Earth Summit. And now, a brief news update. Then we go in-depth with artist Jen Troot. So now, the news. As the environment and global warming continues to evade any real discussion by the presidential hopefuls, this week, Hillary Clinton made news as she attempted to introduce the subject into one of her news conferences. You have to give her credit for at least trying to talk about the issue. Unfortunately, the story leaked out that the question was asked by a young woman at the request of a Clinton campaign staff manager. Since then, this gaffe is regaled as evidence that she's no better than anyone else. Unfortunately, the media has focused on this aspect of the story and as yet have not covered at all what she actually said about addressing global warming. Time for a reality check. Oil spills are mucking up the oceans and beaches in San Francisco and Russia this week. 58,000 gallons of heavy fuel oil were released into San Francisco Bay following the collision of a massive container ship with a pier supporting the Bay Bridge. Rescue workers and 1,000 volunteers are working around the clock to save as many of the 1,000 or more birds and sea mammals slobbered by the toxic fuel oil. Estimates are that it will take weeks to stabilize the situation. At the same time, rescuers recovered the bodies of 3 sailors after a Russian freighter sank near the Black Sea, resulting in a slick of oil washing onto the beaches throughout the area. 30,000 birds have died, and fears are that the damage to fish may be devastating. As many as 10 ships sank or ran aground in the northern Black Sea region during a fierce storm that lashed the waters with 18-foot waves. Russian authorities are predicting that it will take years to fix the damage. It is considered a very serious environmental disaster. And finally, from Valencia, Spain, the UN's top climate official challenged world policymakers Monday to map out a path to curb climate change, charging that to ignore the urgency of climate warming would be nothing less than criminally irresponsible. Ivo de Boer issued his warning at the opening of a week-long conference that will complete a concise guide on the state of global warming and what can be done to stop the Earth from overheating. It is the fourth and last report issued this year by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, co-winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Environmentalists and authors of the report expected tense discussions on what should be included and what is being left out of the document, which is a synthesis of thousands of scientific papers. The final report is expected to be completed on Saturday. We will be bringing you reports on the findings during next week's show. And that's the news. And a reminder, got a news tip? Send it to your Voice of the Earth here at wildsidenews.com. And now to our special in-depth look into the life and passions of visionary Earth artist Jen Troot. There's so many ways that people are getting involved in trying to help this Earth survive and perhaps heal and find a way for us to relate to it in a way that makes sense again, and it comes in all forms. Change requires all sorts of players to succeed. We have lots of people who are out getting involved in politics. There's people doing music. Al Gore is out there doing films. And as well, there's many people doing various forms of art that talks and communicates and informs us about the Earth and our relationship to it. Some people might call this nature art. Some people might call it environmental art. The other day, I was lucky to go to a local art gallery here outside of San Diego, to the Cannon Gallery, which is north of San Diego a bit in Carlsbad. They do have typically very fine work there. And I entered expecting to see something nice. But I was struck by one of the artist's work who is in San Diego. Her name is Jen Troot, and she's going to join us now to talk about her work. Jen, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Your work is very different than many artists that are involved in sort of earth things, things related to helping us to understand our relationship to the earth. And I'll just give you my impression. The images were, in many cases, startling. They're strong iconographic pieces. Skeletal figures, for example, in green,
and many, many other forms, many beautifully rendered animals as well, just really wonderful foxes and birds, as well as various forms of landscape, including some natural, but then as well many images of the human landscape. You don't just assemble them in simple storylines. Your work is very, very complex in terms of its story. And so throughout the conversation today, I'd like to explore that. And we'll talk about the work. As an artist, why don't you define sort of how you came to be an artist?
Well, I was always working as an artist. I went to art school in Boston, worked as a graphic designer and illustrator. I did storyboards for quite a few years, actually, worked in a lot of large ad agencies. About 10 years ago, I started really focusing on doing my own painting, and I've been doing this environmental painting since then. I did a little bit of portraiture part-time while I was doing the illustration work earlier. But since about 1998, I've been doing the environmental work exclusively, mainly because I've, you know, like so many other people, I've just been so bothered about what's happening. And I finally got to the point in my life where I had to do whatever I could in my, you know, using my talents about it. So I use my skills as a person who worked with advertising for a long time to tell stories in as intense and provocative a way as I can, using a single image, like an ad you would see in a magazine. For a little while, I thought I wanted to do children's books and tell stories about the environment using 30 illustrations at a time. I was used to doing a lot of illustrations to tell a story when I did storyboard work. And then I realized what I really want to do is tell a story in one image. I just love to spend as much time as I possibly can fleshing out one single image and using that one visual to tell the whole story. So that's what I do. I spend a lot of time on each piece.
It's obvious to me that your work in illustration, it serves you well in terms of your mission. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about your work, is the fact that it's exciting work to look at. It's interesting work to look at. You use, for example, Barbie doll images, and we'll talk about why. But they're rendered so beautifully, so wonderfully. When you're looking at the images, there's many places for the mind to go to recognize things that are familiar to us, and both in a very friendly way, but also oftentimes in looking at your work, the more you look, the more you realize there's many more layers to the story. So the one thing that I would say, and I encourage people to go to the website, you can see a lot of Jen Truitt's work on today's show page. In terms of having people find more of your work, why don't we just share your website at this point?
Mm-hmm. It's jentrute.com, JENTRUTE.com.
Yeah, that would be a great way to really see what we're talking about here. But even before we get into that, now I want to talk about going back into your own life and a personal life, kind of take the art out of it and talk about you and your relationship to nature. It seems obvious to me that you have spent time really looking at nature. You look at the earth. Your interpretations of animals, I would have to believe that you have a real experience with some of these creatures. I don't know if you've been an outdoor person much of your life, if you've done much hiking, or as a child perhaps you spent time in rural areas or in the country or somehow in touch with nature, but I'm just curious about the deep roots. Is there a deep root to this?
Well, when I was a kid, we grew up in an area that was not all that developed. We were in western Massachusetts, and there was a lot of empty land around us. And my happiest childhood memories all have to do with being out in the woods. A lot of times just by myself, letting the imagination go wild, making forts, just living, you know, some sort of fantasy life in the woods. I really feel sorry for kids today who don't have that access, because gosh, your imagination can really, really run wild if you have that sort of freedom as a kid. And we were all like that. All the kids in the neighborhood were like that. It wasn't anything special. So that's how I grew up. That was sort of buried for a long time. I lived in big cities most of my adult life. And then, you know, it all came back when I just got to the point where I felt it's time for me to act.
This environmental focus has really taken on a true passion in your life for a variety of reasons, which we'll talk about. And why don't you give us an entree to that? Because it does really make a difference in terms of helping people understand. And it's until I talked with you about this, it was interesting work, but now it becomes even more interesting.
What happened to me was I got a wake-up call as an artist, as someone who always wanted to do something about problems out there that bothered me but put it off. I got a cosmic crack to the side of the head. I was diagnosed with cancer in 2000, and I had been working as an illustrator for many years. I wanted to do something with my art regarding the environment, but I was just never quite able to get it done. I was so distracted with everything else I was doing, and at one point I even started doing these paintings in I guess it was 96. And they weren't coming along too well because I was new at it, of course. My house needed to be remodeled. I looked at the painting, looked at the house, and said to myself, who am I kidding? I've got to do something about this mess. I put the painting away. It sat under a sheet for a year while we remodeled. And that was that. So I just kept getting distracted. Well, I got the cancer, and I felt that this was my cue. It was my time to, you know, walk up on stage and do my bit. It was a pretty serious case. They found a mass of tumors the size of a pack of cigarettes. I had 3 recurrences after the initial bout with cancer. I had 8 operations, and it was really intense. But what happened at the outset of all of this was I just really came back to the thought that all I really cared about was, well, to put it bluntly, I realized that if I was going to die from this cancer, I wanted to die out in the woods. That's all that mattered to me. It was the only thing that made sense. Somehow going out by myself out to the mountains or someplace, and just being there alone, looking at the leaves falling and the whatever, was the only way that my whole life would make sense to me, and somehow dying would also make sense. I could handle the idea of dying out there. Just, it's like it brought me back to a certain level of reality that I wasn't living in for a long, long, long time. And that was a shocker to me because I felt like I should want to die around my family and friends or go to a hospice or something like that. And, you know, I just came back to the feeling that that I could handle it somehow if I was out in the woods, you know, alone. So, and as I was sick, I got very introverted. I had trouble in social situations. I felt I had my foot was already in the other, one foot was already in the other world. It's almost like I wasn't really quite here anymore. But I developed a greater connection with animals, plants, young children, very young children. It's almost like that level of consciousness or that level of being is what made sense to me when things got to such an intense state. So I was very, very, very strongly reminded of this reality, and it just brought the whole environmental situation into very, very, very sharp focus. I was committed to doing these environmental paintings at that point because I felt there was a need for this kind of work. I really didn't see anybody else out there doing this sort of imagery, you know, two-dimensional painting I thought, okay, I'm going to do it. So I was pretty into these paintings. They were very, very important to me. They represented everything to me. You know, that's why a lot of them are so intense. I don't pussyfoot around the issue of environmental destruction. Some of the paintings are very much in your face, and they're not what you typically think of when you do think of New Age imagery that sort of does have to do with the environment, like you know, beautiful nature photography, or the images of goddesses and marine life, and there's a lot of very nice, gentle imagery out there. And my work is not like that, because I was at that time trying to convey some ideas that are very disturbing, but I think important for us to face, because I think the sooner we can really face these issues, the sooner we're going to make real change.
You know, I can completely understand what you're saying. Number one, I'm a cancer survivor myself. I'm not going to discuss that, but that dramatically changed my life when I was faced with the prospect that perhaps I really wasn't going to live at all. And that does change one's life, and one can determine that it's time to carry out a mission, that life is not to be taken for granted. The time is perhaps our greatest resource, and it couldn't be very limited. And it also opens one's eyes to meaning, searching for deeper meaning, searching for deeper truth. And I think it sounds as if that's what you were at that point confronted. Facing death, as you have, can force one, if one is sensitive, to really get down to basics. And in many respects, that's what you've done. I know that in my work, what I do in terms of nature and environmental radio, and I always make the distinction, nature and the environment, because the two I find separate. They're related, but they're separate. The environment, you do a lot of environmental work, and we'll talk about that. Some of the issues that relate to the toxicity of our world, the way in which that's affecting life and humans and animals, literally that level of toxicity is exhibited in a most intriguing way in your work. At the same time, you celebrate nature, the beauty of the fox, the various creatures that you find in a natural environment, and you do them very wonderfully. That's nature and the environment. And I think we share that similar sort of need to distinguish between the two. And in my work, I know I'm always conflicted with the challenge to try to make sure that I celebrate the beauty and the wonder, but at the same time pose a level of warning that's significant enough for people to realize that this could all be much different 20, 30, 40 years from now. And as you say, going back to your childhood and the significance of that connection at that deep level with the wonder, with the beauty and magic mystery of almost every living thing, I think we probably share the knowledge that those things may not be around for other people to experience.
You know, the thought of that when I was sick was just devastating to me.
Can you reach in and find out why it was devastating to you?
Because I could relate to it. I felt vulnerable. I felt like I was sick, just like it's almost like I could feel the pain of what some of these creatures are going through. It's almost like I couldn't really relate to it until I was deathly ill.
Suddenly I'm understanding something new about your work.
Yeah.
And that is that, to some extent, perhaps even your cancer, you may feel that it was caused by various environmental factors, toxicity in the environment.
I did have a very serious exposure to toxic chemicals. When I was in my early 30s, I worked at an art studio, and we all used markers that had aromatic hydrocarbon liquid in them that we used to spray through airbrush nozzles, so it would all be in the air, and we would blow our noses, and, you know, blue would come out, and there were 10 of us in a small room, And I developed food allergies and chemical sensitivities within 8 months of working in the studio. And then I continued to work with the markers for another 8 years or so, but I didn't have to use them as often. I definitely had a connection, yeah, early on.
It's interesting, as an artist, I had to confront the fact that some of the stuff that I was working with was radically toxic. Many of the cadmium, for example, in paints, there's many very toxic substances that artists work with regularly. And as you say, they're spraying it and they get it on their hands and things of that nature. And I, of course, always felt that I was invincible and these things would never affect me. But just reaching out there to anyone who's involved in the arts, beware. Be careful, you know, because there was a chemical that I was using to speed up the painting of, in oils that I won't mention the brand name, but I didn't typically use that. But I knew that when I used that in my studio, it smelled terribly. And I eventually got sick where I had this lung thing that just wouldn't go away, and I'm otherwise very healthy, and it scared me because it went on for month after month after month where I just, there's something wrong. And it was obviously from that substance, and I finally said I will never, ever use that again because obviously that was radically affecting me. So that's interesting because I hadn't made that correlation, seeing the fact that so many of your figures, for example, one of the startling pieces, yeah, there's many startling pieces in, for example, the Canon show, but the one that I think most people were drawn to, would be drawn to, will be drawn to, is All for Baby. Mm. It's a large piece. Many of your pieces are fairly large, being 4 by 5 feet or 3 by 5 or somewhere in that scale. So they're relatively monumental work. That's fairly large work for a painter, particularly with this level of detail. All for Baby is, why don't you talk about All for Baby? And I encourage people to look at the image on the website. It's very significant.
Well, All for Baby is a domestic scene from a version of the future that I hope we avoid. There's a figure that looks like a mother, and it looks like a little bit like a Barbie doll. It's wearing very elegant clothes, and it has some jewels, and it's got its hand on a mobile as if it's moving the mobile for a little baby that's on a little bed in front of the mother. And the baby has an arm outstretched to the mobile, and there's a little satin headboard with a little crown embossed in it, and the little mobile figures are very pretty. They have jewel-like little shiny pieces on them, and they sort of sparkle in the sunlight. And they're in some sort of a home that's up high above the outside scene, and there are these huge open windows behind the two figures, so you look beyond the two figures and see what's behind them, and you can tell they're way up high, and down below is a huge expanse of some sort of a city. Now, what's a little funky about this scene is that the animals on the mobile are mutated. They have three eyes or one eye or five legs, but they all look happy, you know, like little normal animals. And the scene out the window is of a brown cityscape. It's very dark. There are these huge billowing brown clouds that look like they're coming over the city very ominously, and it looks very, very polluted, and the city looks like a huge slum almost. Off in the distance, there's a tower that says, going up the tower, it says Univew, like a big corporate tower, and at the top, there's a winged shape, like Univew has a winged logo. Now, when you look at the mom's head, she has these big winged things coming out of the side of her head that look an awful lot like the logo on the tower. And when you look at the baby's head, The baby has two little buds at the top of her head, and they're actually, you know, going to grow into these winged things when she gets older. There are two cats in the room. They're, you know, they're the domestic animals, and they're not mutated, but they're a little off, too. They don't have any hair, and one looks very intently at the baby as she reaches up to the mobile. And the other one is a little kitten lying on the bed, and he looks funky, too. Now, there are these little towers also in the background that have lit eyes. So it looks like there are these things out there that are looking over the city. The mobile has a little thing at the top that has these two little lights in it that look kind of like eyes, and they're looking down at the baby. The kitten on the bed is playing with a little bug that has wings that are the same shape as the Barbie's ears and the Uniview tower. So this bug looks like he might be part of whatever's going on too, and he has two little eyes. He doesn't look like a normal bug. He has two little lights at the front of his head as if he might be part mechanical. The support on the mobile that attaches it to the bed has the word Uniview written into it. It's ornate and it's fancy, and it looks like it's part of the fancy design of the mobile. So the mobile is a Uniview mobile, and it's got this little thing at the top that looks down at the baby. So these people are the privileged class. This is as good as it gets in this version of the future. And the mom looks placid because she's used to this. The baby looks a little bit uneasy, like she's reaching up to the mobile and she's not quite sure of what she's reaching up to. She's supposed to look a little like she's reaching up to her future. And the whole thing is, it's very, very strange. So,
my first view of All for Baby, I sometimes like to kind of walk through a show quickly and get some first impressions. And so my first view of this was it's a very happy painting in many respects. It's a beautiful Barbie doll.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a beautiful Barbie woman, okay?
Yeah.
And the baby is a happy little baby. Beautiful, plump, and,
yep.
And rosy cheeks and, mm-hmm. You know, plump thighs and hands and fists and fingers, and all beautifully rendered, too. Just beautifully rendered. And upon first looking, I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. It could be taken at such a simple level. And then on second look is when I began to realize that there's so much more to this piece. Art is so subjective. I have these fears that our world is becoming that. It is a Uniview. It is a plastic. There's a plastic nature to almost everything in the house, for example. There almost seems to be a plastic sheen to almost everything, as if there's almost a little bit too much plastic in our DNA, that we're becoming plasticized. And it can sound like a bit of a cliche, but it's done so well. It isn't a cliche. It's a truly a statement. I think it's and this concept of the Uniview, it's a probably, I don't know if you intended it for it to be a commentary on the dark side of globalization, but quite honestly, that is one of the things that I would interpret it.
Yeah, I was sort of alluding to the way media is becoming more and more monolithic. You know, we're getting our information from fewer independent sources, and it's also about the power of a gargantuan corporation and how that can infiltrate into every aspect of a person's life. And in this case, it's even controlling the way their body parts grow. So they're completely hooked into the big source out there. This one source probably controls everything that they know about what's going on around them, and it's all seen. It's got its spies everywhere.
There are no trees or living things in the environment outside of the house either. I could find them, but I don't see them there.
No, you're right. Nothing. So you can only imagine what life is like for people living down there in the city below.
Again, this is a painting called All for Baby, and it's difficult for us to talk too much about it without having people see it. Hopefully, do look on the website as we're talking about this.
We continue our in-depth discussion with Jen Trout when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.